Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science news and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. Here's a scientist soundbite.
It turns out that people, in general, are doing a lot better in terms of health, education, welfare, and although the economic gap is widening dangerously, the overall averaged income and prosperity of the world is increasing.
That was futurist Jerome Glenn, co-author of the State of the Future report. By studying world trends in areas such as energy, food, and technology, a global think tank called the Millennium Project projects what the world might be like in the next 10 years through a yearly report called The State of the Future. Here to explain more is Jerome Glenn, the executive director of the Millennium Project. Mr. Glenn, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So tell us about the State of the Future report. What did it find this year in 2011, whether globally humanity is winning or losing the future?
Well, we track over 28 variables in one chapter on the State of the Future Index. It finds that most of the indicators of progress for civilization are improving. While there's some uncertainty about some, and obviously areas like environment, CO2, organized crime, general violence, corruption, and participation of people in voting are actually going the wrong direction. Whereas it turns out that people, in general, are doing a lot better in terms of health, education, welfare, although the economic gap is widening dangerously. The overall averaged income and prosperity of the world is increasing.
Maybe you could describe the process of what goes into this. From what I understand, it's a panel that looks into indicators that have actual research behind them. Tell us more about what goes into this report, please.
Yeah, this is the most extensive analysis of how to measure the future that has ever been done. And here's my evidence. When we began in 1996, we asked people what's going on in the world that could become a big deal in the future. And then we asked, because a lot of people looked at problems, then the next year we asked what could become a big deal that's good for humanity. In the third year, we put both of these together. And then we asked people, how would you measure progress or regress on these indicators? And there was something like 119 indicators. But we had to have real data behind them. When I say data behind it, we want to have 20 years of past data that we can project out 10. And then we asked these several hundred scholars, futurists around the world, to rate each of these variables in terms of how could they be worse in 10 years and how could they actually be plausibly better in 10 years. So that gives us a range between good and bad, so to speak. And then we add up all these indicators in this little mathematical process to create an integrated State of the Future Index, and that's how we do it.
And the State of the Future report is released every year. Would you tell us what's new in this report for 2011?
We've identified something around over 20 factors that are likely to increase food prices. And all of these factors, every single one, is going up. And this is extremely frightening because if current trends continue, business as usual, in 20 to 30 years, we're going to have an awful lot of social instability about food prices around the world. So we're going to have to change the way we eat, how we produce things, and what we eat if we are to make a more stable future. So those are a couple of slices. We also did one on the future of arts and industries about what new forms like augmented reality and new kinds of virtual systems in the arts and entertainment that are coming up in the future.
How is this report being used?
Well, think of it as a utility. Some people use our report to teach in universities. Some governments use it as input into their scenario process for the future of their countries. Businesses use it for their strategic planning process. It's a little bit like saying, what's the advantage of thinking ahead? But also to affect the policy and planning. The purpose of policy, of course, is to change the future. If it's going in a direction you don't like, then you've got to change policy.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about the 2011 State of the Future report?
We created the State of the Future to give a framework for thinking about the future as a system. We can't just look at one thing in the human body and to understand what's going on, just like in the world. The world is complex, but we can simplify the systems of the world, so to speak, to give a framework for thinking. So that, I think, is very important to understand, that just coming up with one thing or one issue or one challenge is not really helpful in the world.
Mr. Glenn, thank you for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
That was Jerome Glenn of the Millennium Project. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. One of the ultimate questions of science is, where did life on Earth come from? New evidence from the U.S. space agency NASA makes the strongest case yet that the chemical building blocks for life came from space. Meteorites have been found in the icy continent of Antarctica that scientists claim contain what are called nucleobases. These are compounds used by nature to make DNA. Here to explain more is chemist Michael Callahan of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. He's the lead author of the report on the meteor findings published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So what are the main findings of the report you co-authored on meteorites and the building blocks of life?
Well, our research results have shown the building blocks, the nucleobases, which are the building blocks of your genetic material, DNA, are found in meteorites. People have known this for actually the last 50 years or so, but no one's been able to really prove definitively if these building blocks of DNA were extraterrestrial in origin or if they were the remnants of terrestrial contamination in the meteorite.
These building blocks, apparently they're not the building blocks of life that we see here on Earth. They're something different, and that's how you know that it's not just contamination.
That's correct. That's exactly right. When you look at biology, biology likes to use certain chemical compounds. And so if you count the number of nucleobases used in biology, it's really predominantly five structures, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. It only uses five structures for the nucleobase components. When you start doing chemistry, where you're taking simple ingredients, simple precursors like these hydrogen cyanide molecules and water and ammonia, and you start reacting them, when you start analyzing these products from these reactions, you get the biological nucleobases, which you see in biology, right? But you also get other things. This chemical reaction doesn't really discriminate so much like biology does, and it makes a whole plethora of different types of molecules and variations of those nucleobases. And so that's what we're seeing in the meteorite. We're seeing the variation of structures in the meteorite. So it's not necessarily some sort of alien or foreign DNA. It's what we observe because we're looking really at a chemical reaction. Now, if those components can be used later on, which is what the idea is why this would be so important, that, you know, these meteorites could have brought in some essential ingredients that may have assisted the origin of life on Earth, could those other unusual structures have participated in some sort of important chemistry? It's very well possible it could have been important, but you don't see them now because over time, maybe evolution or things there in place change things enough that you don't see them anymore. But it's still important to kind of know what the starting material is.
Yeah, what's the impact of these meteorites to life on Earth? Maybe you could walk us through how meteorites can seed life, bringing in material from space. Walk us through how this works for listeners.
Sure. So there's theories out there that when the Earth formed, there was a period very early in the history of the Earth called the Late Heavy Bombardment, where the planet was being constantly impacted by meteorites and comets and other foreign objects, you could say. And when you start studying these meteorites, you start finding a host of organic molecules that you do see in modern biology, such as amino acids. And now with our research, we can say nucleobases. And so these are essential components in all of life as we know it. And so you can kind of imagine you know, to get to life, it uses some pretty complex molecules. And so how do you build up those complex molecules? Where are the starting materials? Well, we think that meteorites could have been a significant contributing factor to bringing in some necessary material. And then that brings up the intriguing question, well, if this is occurring on Earth, could this be occurring elsewhere as well? So maybe these meteorites flying all over the universe, impacting different objects and bringing in some pretty important things. And if maybe the conditions are right, maybe the same sort of process for life could be happening elsewhere. So the likelihood of life elsewhere has kind of increased just a little bit more, I think, because these meteorites, you could say they're pretty ubiquitous, bringing in some important components as, you know, as we view them as important, because of course we see them in biology.
That was NASA scientist Michael Callahan. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. And now we bring you a story on post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. On the line is Paula Schnierer, Deputy Executive Director of the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder at the U.S. Veterans Administration. She's here to tell us about the latest science on PTSD as it affects military servicemen and women. Dr. Schnierer, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What do scientists know at this point in 2010 about PTSD and about who gets PTSD and who doesn't?
Well, the first thing we know is that most people exposed to a traumatic event such as combat don't develop PTSD, but that certain factors make a person more or less likely to develop it. Probably the most important factor is the nature of the combat or the traumatic event. So the more severe it is, whether someone's injured, how long it lasts, how many times it occurs, increases the risk. Furthermore, what happens after a person's been traumatized also makes a difference. A supportive recovery environment, the absence of stress and further traumas can all be protective. Conversely, returning to further stressors, having additional traumas, marital difficulties, job problems, and the like can make things more difficult. And lastly, even though in chronological order it's the reverse, who a person is going into a traumatic event matters too. The experiences a person has had leading up to deployment to a war zone or any kind of event can make the person more or less likely to develop a PTSD. One factor is the person's age. Up to early adulthood, the younger a person is, the more likely they are to develop PTSD. The more education they have, the less likely. If they've had childhood stressors and trauma, they're more likely.
Well, Dr. Schnierer, thank you for speaking with us today. I appreciate it. What's the most important thing that you want people today to know about soldiers and PTSD?
Perhaps there's two. And the first thing is that not all soldiers have PTSD. Even soldiers and other military personnel who have problems readjusting to society, well, that's normal. And coming from a war zone back to a large town or a small town in the U.S. or elsewhere, it can take some time. So your listeners should remember that not everyone returning from Iraq or Afghanistan has PTSD. The second thing is that we have effective treatments. So any of your listeners who are struggling with PTSD, or if they know someone struggling with PTSD, the important thing to know is that those people can be helped.
That was PTSD expert Dr. Paula Schnierer. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for EarthSky.
each other in every way. We go together, we are alike, we complement each other. Ah, that's right. At last I have it, even better than I imagined. I can't believe I nearly gave it up, I nearly watched the dream collapsing. I can't believe it, even sleeping I wouldn't dream it. Understandably, I'm feeling satisfied. What an odd and incredible feeling. This is the pinnacle, everything's eventual. Now I'm not sure exactly what I'm waiting for. This is my fantasy, exactly how I dreamed it'd be. What's this? A smile. Goodness, it must have been a while.
We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. You might think of scientists as just dealing with the abstract world, but the making of things, useful things, can lead to new scientific discoveries. One scientist who's done just that is inventor and materials scientist Joseph D. Simone, a professor of chemistry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and professor of chemical engineering at North Carolina State University. Dr. D. Simone, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, your research spans a broad range of science, medicine, technology, chemistry, material science. How would you describe what you do?
We lie at the interface of a lot of different things. And I think at one level, we're problem solvers. Another level, we're entrepreneurs. And at the end of the day, we're material scientists. We like to apply the capabilities of polymer science and new polymer chemistries to tackle problems that range mostly today in life sciences, but as well in some areas of colloids and material sciences.
Will you speak to the process of making things, something that you're very good at from what I understand? Two examples, the bioabsorbable stents, and also something that you're working on nowadays as well, these incredibly small and precise templates to deliver new medicines inside the body. Talk a little bit about this process of how making things can lead to innovation. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so the stent one was a terrific example and a terrific opportunity and experience. I met a man named Richard Stack, who was an interventional cardiologist at Duke University. He had shared with me this idea of having a bioabsorbable stent. He needed the polymer support and technology to help pull this off, and the challenge is daunting. I mean, most stents are metal, but you look back and you realize that before there were stents, it was just angioplasty, just opening up a blood vessel. And most people did okay with that, but sometimes those blood vessels would collapse and they needed to be propped open. And so a stent made a lot of sense. But why have a permanent prosthetic to a temporary healing issue? And that was the premise, and that was Richard's idea. And so we worked closely with him and developed a polymer-based stent that had the requisite mechanical properties to be balloon deployed and act like a metal stent, and then would provide mechanical support, but eventually would dissolve or degrade just like a bioabsorbable suture would. And then after a couple years, it's gone. And so it's pretty exciting to see it go from basic concepts in less than a decade into many, many people. And now what we're doing is bridging two other areas. So actually back in my PhD work at Virginia Tech, I got exposed to a technology called lithography. And lithography is a basis by which polymers are used to make patterns on silicon wafers to make circuits, transistors. And it's the backbone of the semiconductor industry. And what we're doing now is that we're harnessing the manufacturing techniques of the computer industry and applying those techniques to make new vaccines and medicine. And so we're basically making particles, delivery vehicles, that are extremely uniform, that have all the precision and uniformity of transistors, and applying that to making particles. And so now we have a platform we call PRINT, Particle Replication and Non-Wetting Templates. It's a particle molding technology, and to make particles of controlled size and shape. And then we bring our chemical acumen and capabilities to design new chemistry such that we can make particles that are highly functional to do things that we want them to do. Deliver nucleic acids, deliver chemotherapy agents, seek out certain types of cells versus other cells, And so we're using these details of size, shape, chemistry, and elasticity to enhance the performance of vaccines and medicines.
That was inventor and materials scientist Joseph D. Simone. That's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, 100 Flowers, Maneja Beto, and the Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't have you terrified. What you don't know won't hurt ya. But you don't know, but you don't know, but you don't.